The following Stealing the Mind of America presentation by Representative Helen Chenoweth is entitled Christians and Politics, an Inside Look. For a complete audio and video teaching tape catalog, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177.
It's wonderful being here with you today. I've been on, as you know, the Congress has been on recess for about a month, so America's been safe for a month. You know, I live in Idaho, and I work in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is a mighty interesting place. They have the strictest gun control laws in the nation, and yet we have more crime in Washington, D.C. than any place else in the nation. Doesn't that tell you something about gun control? But it's great to be out here in the West. What remains is the land of the free and the home of the brave, and away from Washington, D.C., which is the nation's only work-free drug zone. You know, Oliver North has said that Washington, D.C. is the only city in the world where you can go from one side of the city to the other and never leave the scene of the crime. I think he's right, don't you? We're working hard to make some changes, and we realize that after we took office in 1995, that rather than being able to make great big changes, we've only been able to make small changes. But what that has shown us is that although we're warriors in the fight for liberty, and although many of us really do understand that where the Holy Spirit is, there is liberty. And that is precisely the reason why I called for a national day of not only prayer, but prayer, fasting, and humiliation. I ran my bill out under a special or suspension of rules, so it required a two-thirds vote, supermajority vote in the House. And you know, we lost that bill, that resolution, by only two votes. But one of the reasons why I drafted that resolution, and I will be running it out again, and we will win with your hope and your prayers and your support from home, because our nation is involved in a great civil war. We've come together today in order to be able to realize that we must steal the mind of America. We must make it sharp, and we must use each other and each other's idea as iron sharpens iron. But what is happening is the mind of America is being stolen by a cultural war that is devastating, a cultural war that is also a deep spiritual war. And when we realize that across the world, darkness seems to be setting in. We have gone through one of the most morally dark times in the history of civilization in America, when we just had to go through an impeachment of a sitting president and a trial that failed to convict in the Senate. I was the original co-sponsor of the bill of impeachment, and exactly at 1 year and 3 weeks before the actual impeachment, Bob Barr and I and about two other members dropped the bill of impeachment, because we felt, even before the Monica Lewinsky issue surfaced, we felt that the rule of law was being so degraded that we had to do something to bring it back to America and replace an administration that has lost respect for the common sense of the American people, lost respect for our rights, lost respect for the vision of America. And so, because the rule of law was being denigrated so, we felt that it was important to move through the impeachment process, plus the fact that national security was no longer what it should be in America. When we first found out about Chinese espionage and the Chinese stealing, our ability to remain the number one nation in terms of military superiority in the world, we are no longer. We no longer have the 20-year military lead that we did before the Clinton administration took over. You know the details of that, but that is what prompted us to drop the bill of impeachment. And the media in Idaho and across the nation, when we sent our press release out, simply dropped the press release in the round files thinking, well, there's a bunch of dissidents out there in the House of Representatives that have a bright idea that's going to go nowhere. Exactly 1 year and 3 weeks later, it not only went someplace for the first time in American history, we did impeach a sitting president. And impeachment occurred not because it was political, because if the same instances and occurrences had happened in an administration held by my party, I would have been the first to drop a bill of impeachment. But it didn't, and so I want you to remember that impeachment does not occur in the Senate. Only the trial and conviction occurs in the Senate. Impeachment occurs in the House. But because of what our nation was going through, and because of what not only was happening in Washington, D.C., but out across the nation, which occurrences finally culminated in what happened in Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, in this very state. Because of the inspirational testimony of a man by the name of Darrell Scott in front of the House Judiciary Committee, whose daughter looked at her killers and said, seconds before she lost her life, yes, I do believe in God. And so I felt, wasn't that wonderful? That wonderful martyr of those two girls. And so I felt it was time to drop a bill that said America as a nation, this wonderful place that we call home and the rest of the world calls America, it was time for this great nation not only to bow in prayer, but also go through fasting as a nation and humiliation, repentance, and reconciliation. You see, those calls had often been given in this nation from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, but the last time that call was made was by President Abraham Lincoln in April of 1863, when this nation was torn asunder by a great civil war. Lincoln made this proclamation, and I drafted my proclamation after his ideas. We have been preserved, President Lincoln said, these many years in peace and prosperity, and we have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which has preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. And we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our own hearts, that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us. It behooves us, therefore, to humble ourselves before the offended power, to confess our national sins and to pray for clemency and forgiveness. I felt it was time. And it was a great debate. Although we didn't win this round, the essence of our ability to win overall is perseverance. The original word being hupomone, we will persevere, because that is a commandment, as we study the word perseverance in the scriptures, that is a commandment of ours, and that's what makes good soldiers out of us. You know, and I do seek your prayers for the success of the next resolution, and we will succeed. I do want to also share with you, though, that those who debated against and voted against the prayer resolution, that narrow one-third of the Congress, actually clapped when it went down. You know, God will not be mocked. And I felt very sorry for them, and I felt sorry for our nation. So you see, I'm building you a picture of exactly where we are today. Another thing that is happening is that not only must we steel our minds against our minds being stolen, our culture being stolen, our rights being stolen, but our very land and our very property. Strange things are happening. I mean, today people are actually saying things that we know to be wrong or right. That we are in a state now of where we're worshiping the created instead of the creator. We are in a state now where there is a new world religion that is beginning to embrace us, and because the American people generally have become apathetic, it's even infiltrating into our churches, the new green religion. A religion that is so imbued in the agencies of the federal government that now the Fish and Wildlife Service will not let a man in New York build a stone fence against the encroachment of rattlesnakes that that will move down and across his property. They have taken this man to court because he wants to build a stone fence or keep a stone fence present and constructed. They are asking him to take it down because it violates the migratory patterns of the timber rattlers when they come out of hibernation in New York. The Delphi sandfly down in Southern California stopped construction of a hospital and cost the taxpayers millions of dollars because the plans for that hospital would rise to the flight corridor of the Delphi sandfly. And they didn't want the hospital to interrupt the flight corridor of the Delphi sandfly. The red-cockaded woodpecker is a little woodpecker that resides in dead and dying pine down in southeastern states in the United States. It's not like Woody the red-headed woodpecker that I read about when I was a little girl. It's a frumpy little brown woodpecker. And they now have our military going around laying out habitat breeding grids for the red-cockaded woodpecker. They are now controlling takeoff and landing patterns from Air Force bases down there from eastern Texas all the way through the southeastern states in order not to upset the breeding patterns of the red-cockaded woodpecker. Now, I find it hard to believe that a bird that beats its head all day long on a log for food is going to be upset in its breeding habits because a plane flies overhead. Up here in the Northwest, you know, we have been, many of our communities have been destroyed. Hundreds of thousands of jobs have been lost because on the West Coast they have listed the spotted owl. And the spotted owl, they say, must have 2,000 acres per breeding pair of spotted owls. Now, Americans can do just fine in a condominium. I don't understand why it takes 2,000 acres per breeding pair of spotted owls, but that's the logic today. And the salmon, the great salmon, has been listed. And probably one of the first things that I said when I ran for Congress was memorable to the environmentalists, and they took great umbrage over it, because I said, I don't understand why we're listing the salmon as an endangered species, because they fish for it. They catch it, they stuff it in cans, they sell it commercially off the shelves at Albertsons. So how can you say it's a listed and endangered species when we're commercially harvesting it and selling it in commerce? Well, you see, they had no answer for that. And so what they did was print up millions of bumper stickers that said, "Can Helen, not salmon." And we found a lot of them in Washington, D.C., and in even other states than in Idaho. But thank goodness my constituents in Idaho, and because of the support of many of you across the nation, we were able to win an election where I was targeted. The number one target from the Congress by the Democrats in the year 1996. And out of their 10 top targets, only two survived. And it certainly was not because of any genius that comes from me, but because of the support from the American people from all over, and because of the because of God's grace. And I know that. And I know that I am simply the clay and He is the potter. And every day I ask Him to mold me and make me in His will for that day. And so I find that because of that, because He is a great protector, that even though I've been in the crosshairs many times of the White House, of Sidney Blumenthal, the liberal media, I can testify to the fact that His grace is sufficient for all of our needs, truly, even in the worst of wars. But one of the biggest assaults is being made on us today is in private property rights. Now, before I went to Congress, I had a client whose name was John Posguy. He resides in Pennsylvania, in a little town called Morrisville, Pennsylvania, which is a suburb of Philadelphia. He resides there because although he was born in Hungary, his dream always was to come to America, to be able to live in the land of the free and the home of the brave. He didn't see how he could ever come to America and be an American. But then the Hungarian Revolution occurred, and as the Russian tanks were moving into Hungary, and Hungary reached out to America and cried out for help, "We don't want the communists in our country. Please, America, help us." We had been bound by an agreement that had been made after World War II that we would not interfere with satellite countries next to Russia, and so the communists moved in. And there was a handful of men who led the Hungarian Revolution, who fought with everything that they had. Most of them died in order to fight communism. John Posguy was one of those. He was able to escape the Hungarian Revolution and the communist takeover, and he fled into Poland, across to Canada, and finally into America, where he finally made his way to Morrisville, Pennsylvania. He learned how to speak English. He became a naturalized citizen, and he says one of the greatest days in his life was when he was able to become an American citizen. He met another Hungarian lady, and they were married and had two daughters. John Posguy was a skilled mechanic, and he worked for one of the major tractor companies in Morrisville. And suddenly, this tractor company pulled out, and he no longer had a job. But he and Mary had been able to save their money, and so he bought a run-down old shack next door to their property, to their home, their little narrow home, right across the street from billboards, and he fixed it up, and he was able to put a sign out front. I saw the picture. He was so proud to display Posguy Truck Repair, and he worked day and night. And his children, his two girls, told me that a badge of courage that they always felt when they looked at their dad's hands was the fact that his hands could never come clean, because there was so much grease ground into the cracks in his hands. But that was a badge of courage, because he worked so hard to support his family. And when the girls graduated from college, another American dream, they bought the billboard space for a month across the street from John Posguy's home. And they put on this billboard, "Thank you, Mother and Dad, for the wonderful privilege of being able to complete our college education. You've made another part of our American dream come true." Well, together the family decided that they would buy a piece of property across the street from their home, take down the billboard, and this piece of property had been historically used as an old junkyard, unofficial junkyard. An adjacent property owner to this property Posguy's were buying, that had had toilets and bed springs and bathtubs and bottles and thousands of tires thrown out by the adjacent landowner, who was a tire repair store, thrown out on this land. So after Posguy checked the local planning and zoning and the county authorities and had deemed that this land had been designated as industrial commercial land, he set about pulling out 2,000 tires and all of the junk that had been illegally disposed of there for years. Running kitty corner across this property was a little stream that whose bed had been built by the city of Morrisville in order to allow wastewater from the rain runoff to exhaust out to eventually the Delaware River. And so they set about cleaning up this property. And when they pulled out the tires, the water was able to course through as it had been naturally purposed when they built the ditch. But you see, when the tires were in, illegally disposed on the property, water backed up against the tires and stood, sometimes for 20 days. And out of this area grew cattails. And so when John Posguy and his girls pulled those tires out, they, by definition of the Environmental Protection Agency's definition and the Corps of Engineers' definition of a wetland, they destroyed a wetland. And so, one day, the government arrested John Posguy in his workplace, and they put him in leg shackles and irons, handcuffed him, and took him off. This great freedom fighter, his children didn't know where he was taken, and they didn't know how to find out. They finally found out that he was down there at the marshal's office, and they called and said, "How do we get our dad out of jail?" And they said, "We don't have an attorney." And the response from the marshals were, "Don't worry about an attorney. Just bring your checkbook, you can post bond, and we can let him come back home." So they rushed down there, posted bond, and they said, "Thank you very much. But just one small detail. Before we allow John to come home, what we need is to be able to search the house and the property for guns." Well, now, usually a search warrant is granted, especially for guns, if there is a reasonable cause to believe that guns were used in the commission of the crime. Now, this didn't match the test of logic at all, but there was no lawyer there. How could these people really defend themselves? And so they said, "All right, anything to get their dad home." And so the agents came in with their guns on and their badges of authority, and they went through the entire house. They tipped up the mattresses, they took the sheets off the bed, they went through the drawers, the lingerie, the college papers, everything. And they said it was a very frightening experience. Well, finally, they didn't find guns. John said there wasn't guns there. But, yes, indeed, there wasn't, and finally they let John come home. He had to stand trial in the federal district court, and it was a jury trial, and the judge strictly ordered the jury, "Now, you will find this man guilty or innocent based on these rules and regulations, that a wetland consists of these four definitions. If there's standing water for 7 days, if there is plants indigenous to a wetland, such as cattails or watercress, if you dig down 18 inches and there's moisture in the ground, that's the third criteria. The fourth criteria is if the soil is hydric in nature." And Mr. Posguy's case met three of the four criteria. And the second point is, simply, did he destroy that wetland by pulling the tires out? And the judge instructed the jury, "It makes no difference if God formed the wetland or if man forms the wetland." So the jury had no choice but to return a guilty verdict under those strict definitions. So John Posguy was deemed to be guilty of a felony. It was a criminal felony, and he was sentenced under the new federal sentencing guidelines, which would not allow him parole. He was sentenced for 30 years. That's when I came in on the case, 30 years. I first knew John Posguy in Allenwood Federal Penitentiary. And having heard the heartbreaking story from his daughters, one of the first things I did was look at his hands. His hands were very clean. the badge of courage was gone, because you don't do that kind of work in prison. They hadn't totally destroyed his spirit yet, so I worked with their family to try to get the president, George Bush, to commute the sentence. We weren't successful in that, but we were able to elevate that story nationwide, and so even the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, all editorialized for the John Podesta side. Finally, we were able to get him out on early parole with an ankle bracelet around his ankle, his freedom fighter, with the agents knowing every move he made. But he was finally able to come home. I was in my home in Boise when I got a call from John Podesta, who was absolutely furious because he had just received a letter from the Department of Immigration, Naturalization, that he was being returned to Hungary because he was a convicted felon. Now, I tried to fight with a cool head, but I'll tell you, I was one mad 5'9½ brunette. I was absolutely furious over that. We got that set aside. But ladies and gentlemen, John Podesta's spirit will never be the same. It will never be the same. And when something like that happens to a neighbor, whether he believes in everything that we believe in or not, when it happens to him, it will happen to us sooner or later. Unless we understand that our freedoms and our property are being taken from us inch by inch, and if we aren't willing to stand and fight and be willing to stand in the crosshairs and take the spiritual bullets that come from the side of darkness and still stand, we will lose this battle. We will lose this battle that will have the consequences of losing our liberty as much as if we lost in World War II to the Nazis. Because inch by inch, we're losing our freedoms to worship, our freedoms to raise our children as we know is best, our freedoms to keep and bear arms, our freedoms to have our property protected unless it's taken for a good reason, under due process and just compensation. You see, because of the political correctness of today, little sympathy is extended to our landowners who are losing their values because of the Clean Air, Clean Water, Endangered Species Act, wetlands, whatever it may be that the bureaucrats may dream up as a response to certain organizations who have certain mindsets about taking our property. It comes as no surprise because even though the Berlin Wall came down and Russia is not as big there that they were before, Karl Engels did say, you complain about us wanting your property and to do away with private property. He went on to say in the Communist Manifesto, precisely that is just what we intend to do. And we thought, oh, we can't get too extreme and talk about that because we will be regarded as extremists. Well, extremism is never too great a virtue in the cause of conservatism and freedom and liberty, as Barry Goldwater said back in 1963. So we must speak the truth. And you see, what happened here is that 400 years ago, a little-known philosophy called Enlightenment began to form in Europe. And then it later spread to America. Isaac Newton, Sir William Blackstone, John Locke, Thomas Jefferson were all a part of this Enlightenment movement. And the underlying principle of the Enlightenment movement is that civilization is governed by certain God-given natural laws. Bless Clarence Thomas. Incorporated in our Declaration of Independence, our founders wanted to guarantee our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which includes private ownership. And violating these laws does not break nature's physical laws, but only results in man breaking himself. You see, that's what's happening. Thomas Jefferson, a deist, a known deist, called these natural laws the laws of nature and of nature's God in the Declaration of Independence. For any human legislature to violate these natural laws is to invite tyranny upon its citizens. Ladies and gentlemen, where are we today?
Tyranny is only able to rule by either ignorance or by force or by apathy. But apathy results in ignorance. And of the two mechanisms, ignorance or force, ignorance is by far the most efficient tool to empower tyranny and to place our people in bondage. Ignorance then completes its task by allowing the perception that the Constitution and the Scriptures are outdated and that they are no longer living instruments designed to protect our fundamental freedoms and liberties. Edmund Burke said, a great English philosopher, said, seldom are men inclined to give up their freedoms unless under some pretext of necessity. And John Adams went on to write that property in its particular application means that dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world in exclusion of every other individual. Practically speaking, our property embraces everything to which a man may attach a value and have a right, and which leaves to everyone else the same advantage. A man's land or his merchandise, including cars and clothes and bank accounts or money or investments, intellectual property or his ideas and opinions are still, or the communication thereof of those opinions, are his property and deserve to be respected and protected. But the federal government has allowed through rules and regulations and case law for the taking of parts or all of private property without automatic due process and just compensation. The Endangered Species Act has gone even further down the road to bondage when we realize that the law doesn't even allow for automatic standing for a person who has been damaged resulting in the loss of income, property, or security. In fact, a case arising out of Oregon called Bennett v. Spears in the Ninth Circuit Court, it was appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court because Bennett won, because he was trying to defend his property against some eels in his irrigation ditch, and the federal government said these suckers, not eels, suckers, were on the threatened list, and so he couldn't let his irrigation water out. He won in the district court. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned it because they ruled that the Endangered Species Act does not allow man to have standing. They are not within the zone of interest of the Endangered Species Act, so therefore man did not have standing to bring a case to protect his property. The Supreme Court overturned it by a unanimous and very scolding decision. But such is the case of the new extreme environmentalism. And the result is a new green religion that is not just American, but worldwide, using personal preferences to turn political policy with force and effective law and the execution of that law. What the neo-environmentalist is doing is that by espousing the noble cause to keep us from destroying the environment and ourselves, then environmental and public interest organizations are trusted by most Americans. Their fear, which is the politics of fear, and their fear-generating and oft-times unfounded accusations are rarely challenged. And when we do challenge them, I can tell you, there come the crosshairs. But Alexander Hamilton warned us very carefully of the time of our greatest danger as a country when he wrote, "It is a truth which the experience of ages has attested that the people are always most in danger when the means of injuring their rights are in the possession of those of whom they are entertaining the least suspicion." Hamilton went on to write that the continual effort and alarm attendant on a state of continual danger, and that's what they promote, the politics of fear, will compel nations most attached to liberty to resort for repose and security to institutions which have a tendency to destroy their civil and political rights. He concluded by saying, to be more safe, they at length become willing to run the risk of being less free. That's where we are today. To be safe, Americans are yielding more and more of our freedoms to an unaccountable and ever-expanding federal bureaucracy. The Heritage Foundation, in fact, reports that unneeded regulations are costing this nation between $800 billion and $1.6 trillion a year. This translates to approximately $8,000 to $16,000 annually for each American family. This is lost production. The Constitution was framed to protect us from that which we are experiencing today and to protect the unalienable rights of all citizens from federal and governmental tyranny, to give ultimate power to the people and to divide and redivide government so that it would always have the checks and balances necessary to prevent power from consolidating into the hands of a few unaccountable people. But that's what's happening today. Indeed, the force of law must be applied equally to the governed as well as the governors. In fact, those of us who are the governors should stand to a stricter accountability under the law as far as our actions are concerned than the governed. Because you see, federal tyranny begins the very instant that the lawmakers and the governors have the autonomy to create laws for their own pleasure or convenience and enforce those laws or their own rules and regulations for their own pleasure and convenience and are not accountable to the governed. Most Americans think that property is simply property that farmers hold or ranchers hold or landowners hold, and it's just dirt and their home. But in defining the meaning and intent of property, as used in the Constitution, James Madison defined it very broadly. So to devalue land by any percentage through regulation is the same as expropriating your own bank account. To take money, have the government just reach in and take money from your bank savings, with perhaps the justification that we need to pay down the national debt, which indeed we do. But I'll tell you, if that happened, that type of action would be met with outrage by voters, and those in public office who voted for the action would soon be voted out of office. Yet somehow it's impermissible to even think that we shouldn't exploit landowners by expropriating a portion of their land or the value of their land to provide some altruistic benefit for others. You see, it's easy for the majority to trample the rights of a minority to achieve, in the majority's estimate, a public good. So easy is it for us to fall into this trap that the majority fails to recognize that the doctrine of the public good is a two-edged sword that can easily slay our own freedoms. The so-called public good is both dynamic and relative, quickly changing with the whims of society. That's why we must protect the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. That must never change. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Warren Burger, who was not one of my favorite justices, did emphasize this point in a case entitled United Steelworkers v. Weber when he wrote, "Beware the good result achieved by judicially unauthorized or intellectually dishonest means on the appealing notion that the desirable ends justify the improper judicial means. For there is always the danger that the seeds of precedent sown by good men for the best of motives will yield a rich harvest of unprincipled acts of others also aiming at good ends." I want to conclude by saying that I think that I have laid out primarily what we are losing. But the fact is that even the scriptures tell us we must never lose hope. You know, Abraham Lincoln said in the Gettysburg Address that we are now engaged in a great civil war, testing whether this nation or any other nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. Friends, let me tell you that we are engaged in the same kind of civil war. But it's a war without bullets and bloodshed. But it tears at the heart and it takes our spirit. And I fear that those of us who are in the fight will no longer trust that pulsing lifeblood that curses and pulses through us and inside of us. And it's the very thing that made this country rise from the mud of valor to become this great nation that it is today. America is worth fighting for. Because as Ronald Reagan attributed to Alexis de Tocqueville, when he said, I came to America to seek her greatness, and I looked in her harbors and her great institutions of commerce and her judiciary and her halls of Congress, and I looked at her constitution and her great waving fields of agriculture. But it wasn't until I went into the churches that I really understood why America is great. America is great, he said, because America is good. And when America fails to be good, America will fail to be great. And that's why Henry Hyde concluded his debate in the impeachment argument on the floor of the House nearly a year ago, that we must maintain the rule of law as laid out by the Constitution. That is the flag of America. And today we must catch the falling flag. Henry Hyde is right. We must catch the falling flag. Because even though we've been assaulted and robbed of our convictions, even though we've been in the middle of this cultural war, there is the fact that our founding fathers led the way and pointed towards freedom and opportunity. And we find ourselves living in the highest civilization in the history of mankind, giving us more physical goods, more toys, more things to divert our mind than we've ever had before. But we must engage in the battle. You know, the Bill of Rights does not have the same righteous feel that the Ten Commandments do. But the text surely same rings with that same righteous feel. You can almost see the patriots and the founding fathers from the past, those rebellious men who wanted to carve out a nation of freedom and liberty. And they are the ones like Jefferson, Washington, Adams, Paine. They pointed the way, and we have made it to the promised land, but we can't let it slip away. This is the land that our immigrants dreamed of, the John Posguys of the world, our fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers. This is the land that Abraham Lincoln said and John Posguy believed is man's last best hope on earth. Look at me. Where else but in America could a skinny little girl running around on a dairy farm in Oregon, a very modest family, be able to get to a place where maybe we can find a life that helps make a difference? That can only happen in America. That's why I love this country so much, because even as a young woman, I could hear in my spirit the fact that a long time ago, my country put in me the gift of freedom and opportunity. And those whispers from long ago said, here you are, kid. We're going to give you freedom and opportunity. Now see what you can do with it. This has happened to all of us. You, the leaders of this nation, truly the leaders of this nation, are here today because you love America. You love God as I do. And that's why I don't so deeply love this nation, because it is a gift from God. We're not going to give it away, are we? This wonderful place that we call home and the rest of the world calls America. God bless you all.
If you'd like information about purchasing this presentation on videotape,
or for a tape catalog of all of the Stealing the Mind of America audio or videotapes, or for future conference information, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177. Or you can write to Compass at 460 Canfield Avenue, Suite 1000, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83815.